TFM.
Welcome back, everyone, to Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, you told me to remind you to tell me about the time you spent with the time-traveling doctor that you once knew. So I'm all ears.
Well, Chris, I could tell you, but it's a very long story, and it involves a lot of timey-wimey craziness, and I don't really know if we have time for that with this podcast, because we have a season finale to discuss, and so I feel like maybe we should probably do that, and then if we have time, we can go into the very long story. So,
All right. But you do know we've already recorded this podcast. People have already listened to it. It happened a long time in the future. And now we're back here.
Yes, because, you know, as we learned in this episode, time is basically irrelevant because we could be in the future already and we don't even know it. And so, yeah, which I'm pretty excited about. I'm ready to walk out my door and see what happened. So
you hear the knocks, right? You hear the knocking.
Exactly.
All right, everyone. We're going to wrap up season 3 of Strange New Worlds today with the final episode of the season, New Life and New Civilizations. And here's a quick rundown of the story. Cleared to return to active duty as director of the Starfleet Judge Advocate General's office, Captain Batel sees a bright future ahead, at least until she learns that she is actually a statue. And not just any statue, but the one that keeps the ancient evil known as the Vesda sealed away so they can't wreak havoc on the universe. That's a job she really needs to get back to because the reconstituted body of Nurse Gamble has greeted Dr. Corby on the planet Skygowan, and things are not looking good for galactic peace. But before she can step back onto the pedestal, she has to take Captain Pike on a trip down memory lane to share their life together in a future where he was never injured while training cadets. And also, Kirk and Spock become one. So, Matthew, we reached the end game with Batel. All the pieces of her story that have been in motion come together here in one grand finale, which I'm sure you'll agree made total sense, right?
Yes.
You've been rendered speechless.
Yes. Just as a breakdown, right, the mm-hmm. combination of Gorn DNA, the flower from Kenfori, and mm-hmm. Una's Illyrian blood have somehow mm-hmm. transformed Batel into this beholder, this protector. Yeah. of the universe from intergalactic evil.
Yeah.
And so if I understand that correctly, that makes less sense to me than it just being that the Gorn were ancient enemies of the Vesda. Yeah. And so therefore they had created this, you know, special role or whatever. And so, you know, I think that would have been much more interesting and would have just helped us with the Gorn and our understanding of them, especially even after the mm-hmm. last episode, right? Like that there's something more to the Gorn that makes them much more fascinating. And if we, you know, right. we wanted to walk down an interesting road.
Yeah.
But this, it kind of just felt a little bit like we got to the end of this season and they're like, well, we've got to wrap this up. What bits can we use from the season that would somewhat make sense for this to happen, and let's put all of that together and just hope that people don't ask questions. Because, you know, what's interesting about this, right, is that so much of this feels like you could mirror it with Deep Space Nine and the story of Sisko, right, with him finally becoming a prophet at the end, right? At the end of the show, spoiler alert for a 30-year-old show, Sisko becomes a god, you know, in the Star Trek universe. And because he becomes a prophet, because he was always a prophet. And the way they work that in through seven seasons really helps. And so I feel like that's the type of story, right, that they were trying to tell here with Batel. And yet, it doesn't work as well because we really have not had the time. Now, if every single episode of this season had been nothing basically but building this storyline, I think you could have done a great job. You could have really dug in. You could have made it made a lot of sense because that would have been kind of your sole focus. You would have had other stories, of course. But I think it just feels like they were trying to pull something off that's too big for the small amount of screen time that we were actually spending on this type of story. And therefore, we literally are just kind of pulling at some threads that we had dangling out there, but don't necessarily seem to... It's like 2 + 2 = 5 somehow. And we're going to say 5 is the right answer. But you're like, huh, that's not what 2 + 2 =.
Well, it depends. If you're asking like ChatGPT 3.0, it might be.
You know, but, just the I Ching of knowledge. So,
So, you know, it's interesting talking about the Sisko thing. The reason that that works is, like you said, they built that over the course of 7 26 episode seasons.
Yes.
Or the first one's not 26, but otherwise. So that story evolved very gradually. So it makes perfect sense in the end because you're building up to it. What they could have done here, what would have worked better both for Batel and for the Vesda, which we'll also talk about, is that if they had done a story like the season of Star Trek Discovery that gave birth to this very TV series, where we find out this sort of a destiny for Michael Burnham over the course of the season, and the pieces start to fall in place, and you also find out, you know, what this other thread is that's going on and so forth. But like, if this season had been about the Vesda and they were the centerpiece of the whole season, and Batel's connection to all of this was also built up over the course of those 10 episodes, then the resolution would have made a bit more sense. The thing about the Chimera Blossom and the Gorn DNA and the Illyrian blood, the explanation is that the Vesda are this ancient evil that is the very foundation of the stories and sort of like genetic imprint of fighting evil that exists in all beings in the universe.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that in a moment.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that, right? So if that's the case, you only need three parts? Is that what it is? Like all the thousands and thousands of species in the universe who would have supposedly come into contact with the Vesda, as long as you've got three parts, it's like a witch's brew, right? You've got to have these three ingredients and you throw them into the cauldron and you get the magic potion and you drink it and you become a beholder statue. Yeah. So what, you know, it's pulling together the strings of the season. Like these are the three things that we've mentioned. So these are the three things that we're going to pull together. But what about the Klingons?
Yeah.
Right. What about the Vulcans or the Cardassians or the aliens from the Andromeda galaxy that we see in
or
the original
the progenitors,
series,
right? Like, or I mean, like, because if you're in the prime timeline, the progenitors were before anything else existed in this part of the galaxy.
Yeah. Right. And most importantly, the Q.
Well,
where's the Q connection
too.
To this? Right.
And
that was just totally abandoned, and there's nothing about it at all.
It was
so
absolutely.
So, you know, but I think the thing about this is that they needed to do something with Batel's character because they can't continue to have this character on the show as they move closer to the original series a point on the timeline. I mean, if it's an alternate timeline, they could, right? But they still insist that it's not, that it's the prime timeline. And therefore, you can't continue to have this character of Batel on the show. So they need to get rid of Batel. But because of the importance of her to Pike, they can't just kill her off, right? They've got to give her some kind of grand send-off. And so that's what they attempt to do here. But because of the short seasons that we get in television these days, and also because of all the time that they waste doing silly episodes instead of building the characters, they just don't have enough build-up to actually make this feel rewarding to the viewer. I mean, I think that's the key, right? Like, it's not, I'm not complaining about it like, oh, it was a terrible thing. It's not a terrible episode, a terrible story, but it just doesn't, the payoff isn't there. Like, it doesn't feel like a rewarding solution, rewarding send-off for this character after what we've watched up to this point.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you've said that so well, is that it's not as if this is like a travesty of an episode. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. It's the end of Enterprise. You know, it's not that, right? Like, I love Enterprise with all my heart. That ending is atrocious and just one of the worst things that Star Trek's ever done. I would watch Spock's brain over that, or Prophet and Lace any day.
Well, Spock's brain is a very entertaining episode.
Exactly.
Actually.
So, Turnabout Intruder. I mean, come on. There's so many episodes that are better than that. anyway, that's beside the point. The point, though, here is that, and we've talked about this season, and I think, I honestly believe that we've both been very fair, and we've both had our criticisms, we've both had our frustrations with the season, but I think you just rightly pinpointed the issue, is that they're so enamored with taking these wild swings, which is what they call them, these wild swings, right? They've actually used
that terminology, right?
And so, and yet, what gets lost is the characters. What gets lost is the importance of the story you're telling for them. And that's why this moment, it feels as though, oh, plot, 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 plot. And you're left with this thing that should feel so incredibly emotional with Batel and Pike and all of that. And in all honesty, I'm very much left kind of cold to it all because it feels so perfunctory instead of important, right? Mm-hmm. It feels as though I'm going through the motions instead of really invested, because we have to do this because, right? And this is kind of one of those things where I feel like they've just done themselves a real disservice by not just coming out and saying, hey, we're in a different universe, and that allows us to tell all the types of stories we want to do. We still get to play around with the original series stuff, just like they did in the Kelvin timeline, but it really allows us freedom because we don't have to be tied to all of this history. And there's this part of them that's still in the back of their minds trying to do that. And it really is just kind of hurting the storytelling. And this is a key example of that, where a moment that should be heartrending and it should just, you know, take your heart, stomp it on the floor, you know, have elephants walk over it. You should feel devastated by what's happening to Pike and to Batel. And yet I'm unfortunately just left in a place where I don't feel that. Part of that is because some of the stuff then that they try to do with Pike and Batel has been done so much better in other places and in other Star Trek shows. And so,
okay, well, let's talk about Pike and Batel's Nexus adventure, because that...
Otis almost spit my bourbon all over the microphone.
Almost spits his bourbon out on the microphone. That was great.
Oh, man.
So, but this part of the story, for me, I did find it very moving. I think the thing is that, And this is the reason why this relationship overall does work on the show, is that Anson Mount and Melanie Scrofano really do have good chemistry together. And the whole sequence of seeing their life together and them have a family and grow old together and all of this that happens, you know, I found it touching. I found it moving. I think that part worked for me. In fact, that part of the episode being there is really important, because otherwise this episode just feels like we got to wrap up our storyline about the Vesda. And so let's just come up with like some way to put them back in the bottle and we're done.
I'm a Vesda in a bottle, baby. Sorry, I had a little Christina Aguilera there. So,
yeah, and another little bit of dancing.
Yeah.
So that worked. But again, it felt rushed. Mm. And Henry Alonzo Myers, the showrunner, he has said that they took inspiration from The Inner Light for that sequence.
Obviously,
right? What's interesting about it, and in a way it does make sense, because The Inner Light is the entire episode, you know, 45, 47 minutes, and those earlier TNG episodes, this feels extremely rushed. Now, of course, it has to be rushed because they've got to fit it into the rest of the episode.
Right.
So, of course, they're going to need to go through it more quickly, but it still feels like I had an emotional reaction to the situation that the two characters find themselves in together as a couple, but it didn't have the emotional impact that The Inner Light has, mm-hmm. where you truly see Picard on his own, living out a whole lifetime and building all of these memories and then what it means to him individually. So I see where they're trying to kind of recapture that. But the other thing about that that I felt is a little bit confusing, and I'm not sure if I'm still 100% clear on what all was happening. I think I know what they were going for, but watching it the first time, they're standing there and Batel is facing off against Gamble, and Gamble's given an actual proper name in this episode called mm-hmm. Zaperez. Zaperez is the Vesda that possesses Gamble, like, takes over his corpse. And as you can see, the Vesda, they love their Z's. Zaperez, the Vesda. I mean, if you play a game of words with friends with the Vesda, I mean, those scores are way up there with all those Z's. But anyway, they're having this face-off. And then right at the key moment, suddenly you're in this other future where Batel and Pike are having their anniversary. Mm-hmm. And you set out on this life of theirs together. And on the first viewing, I really felt like they, in the story, the writers were actually simply jumping us ahead, and that the battle took place, but we don't get to see it. And then this is years later, months later, years later. And then they're doing like a really rapid wrap up of the Pike character.
Right.
To clear the decks for season 4. Now, the only reason that I could say, well, that's not what they're doing, is that we've seen the teasers of Puppet Pike for the Muppet episode that they're going to do. So we know that there's at least a Muppet Pike in season 4.
Yep.
But otherwise, you know, it felt like they were doing a time jump, and they were like rapidly taking us through this future for Pike that was somehow facilitated by Batel as the protector, beholder statue. And then when you start hearing the knocks on the door, you know, if you've watched enough Star Trek and enough television, you can kind of figure out who's at the door each time, right? And, you know, before it's revealed. And so I figured, okay, well, this is not actually what's happening. Like, it's not a time jump. Like, there's more to this, you know. And then suddenly we're back there again for the face-off. And because of it's already established in the story that effect can precede cause, and we know we're dealing with nonlinear time. So part of the takeaway for me was that, okay, Batel needed to, this is why I took away. So this had all happened. It already happened. And Batel is sharing the memories of it with Pike. And by doing that, she's gaining the strength through the love that she's feeling so that she's able to defeat Zaperez and put the Vesta back in the bottle. So that's all fine. Like it all works okay as a story, except that the groundwork that you need to lay for that is missing. So it's just like you're suddenly being thrown this solution. And then the battle is instantly over and that's it. And so we've wrapped up the Vesta story. We've wrapped up the Batel story. And that's where I feel like it wasn't a rewarding solution, even though despite its rushed nature, I do still appreciate the future family life that we get to see between Pike and Batel and watching their children grow up and then watching them grow old together.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually think about it in the depth that you did with the timey-wimey nature of it. I think the thing that I didn't enjoy about it was I did not like that they kept having the knocking, because it, the beauty of something like The Visitor or something like The Inner Light is that the way in which the episode structures that time in that alternate reality doesn't have you with this strange, constant feeling that you're being pulled away from it. And it allows you to follow that story of those characters' lives in those alternate timelines or in those memory moments like Picard is having in The Inner Light to help you truly feel like they are living a lifetime in 28 minutes or, you know, the amount of time that happens in The Visitor, right? Which is years. I mean, Sisko, Jake is an old man by the time this actually gets fixed, right? And so there's something so beautiful about that. And the way that this was structured is it kept reminding you that this isn't happening.
Right.
And yeah, I can see that was the thing that I felt like if you really wanted to do this well, you needed to find a way to structure this that made it feel like, I don't know if this is happening or not, but I'm so glad is happening. And so therefore, that's the thing for me that kept pulling me out of having any emotion about it, because they kept pulling you out of all the emotional moments that were happening with this weird knocking that was reminding you that this actually isn't really happening. It's just going to be kind of a memory that Pike has, but it's done in a way that me as the viewer, the way I'm seeing it, it seems to be the same way Pike is seeing it. And how could you ever feel like this actually ever happened to you, that you actually ever lived this, when every moment just kept feeling like it was interrupted in strange ways, which is not how we live life, right? And so it's really the structure. It's not the idea of it that I dislike, because I thought this was a great way to basically have your cake and eat it too with Pike and Batel as characters. I think that the structure of it was really poorly executed and did not then allow you as a viewer to really experience that in the same way that you would hope Pike would remember it, which is this overwhelming experience of joy in the fact that he has memories of an entire life with Batel that he can pull on. But the way I remember it and the way they show it to me, it feels like he just has these quick vignettes, and that's totally a different feeling.
Yeah. See, I think this is the reason I've thought about it a lot, because the way it's presented, it's not clear to me. Maybe to some people it's perfectly clear, but to me it's not clear what they're trying to achieve.
I agree.
Through the sequence. So going back to The Inner Light and The Visitor, again, those both work really well in part because they are the exclusive focus of the episode, and so you get the entire running time of the episode. Of course, those episodes are also what, about 10 minutes or more? About how long is this episode? Was it 55 or was it an hour?
It's like 55 minutes.
I think it's 55, right? So those episodes are about 10 minutes shorter than this. But those episodes also, like in the case of The Inner Light, the impact of it is that Picard as an individual has this profound experience because of a space probe.
Yeah.
There's no other grandiose end game to that, right? It's not like they're trying to resolve some kind of story or anything. It's just this happened to him. And then in The Visitor, there's a tragedy at the start. And then we follow Jake's attempts through his life to try to get his father back.
Right.
And so there's a clear goal with much lower stakes on a galactic scale than what we're dealing with here with the Vesta. So it's there are individual stakes there. And then the other thing is, I understand the knocking in this the use of the knocking as a storytelling element in this episode, because everything is so compressed through this life that they need an element to kind of keep the momentum going through the sequence of memories.
Knock and three so the knocking, times if the Vesta are coming over, yeah. Twice on the pipe if the answer is no.
No, it's twice on the pipe if the person is Bob. But, but the knocking, it works to keep the momentum going through the sequence because it's not the exclusive part of the episode. But that also, like you said, it pulls you out of some of the emotional weight of what's happening.
Yeah.
And in The Visitor in The Inner Light, you don't need a vehicle like that to keep you moving through, because for one thing, you've got commercial breaks, like you've got natural breaks between the acts,
right?
I'll give you an opportunity to shift the setting if you need to. Whereas here they don't have that. So they have to find a way to make the shifts happen. So I understand the knocking, but the other part of it is that it felt like Pike has no memory of this ever happening, because for him, it hasn't happened yet. But Batel, because of her nature as the beholder, has an awareness of all time in the way Q would, right? But she didn't realize that until she had that encounter with Gamble, I guess, and it kind of activated what we thought was the reaction of the Gorn inside her, but was actually the reaction of her role as the beholder. Because that by that time, the Chimera Blossom and the Gorn DNA and the Illyrian blood, they had all settled in together to a point where they were ready to go. And so her... I felt like here she decided to share these memories with Pike.
Right.
To give herself the power that she needed to defeat the Vesta. So, but then Pike retains the memories. So moving forward now, Pike remembers that he had this life with Batel. But that life with Batel... I mean, this is where, you know, we have debates here on the show, and fans have debates over whether Strange New Worlds is in the prime timeline or in an alternate timeline. Obviously, that life with Batel would have to be in an alternate timeline, because we already know what happens to Pike.
Right.
In the prime timeline. And then that gets into the other thing that I was wondering as this was all going on, and it's supported by... actually dialogue from Pike himself as the memories go on, where initially he's resigned to his fate. You know, he doesn't want to answer Bob because the Admiral wants him to go train these cadets. Mm-hmm. And he's resigned to the fact that he has to go do it and he is going to be injured. And even Batel says that, you know, the family's not going to end. Life's going to be different, but we'll still be together. So then you're kind of in between, you know, what's supposed to happen. But then by the end, and especially at the very, very end, it feels like the writers have taken us in a direction where there are many pathways for Pike now, and the future that we know from the cage and the menagerie and all this is not set anymore. And he could go anywhere now, I feel, with what they've established. And so...
Wow, I did not think it that way, but that is an interesting thought, because then also it leads me to think, well, if you're going to open that Pandora's box, why would you kill Battelle in the first place, you know, or take her away if you're going to play that game?
Well, that gets into where I don't think they have a clear vision of where they're going.
That's an understatement.
Their vision is that we're going to end the series with Kirk in the command chair. Right. That's it. And there's this line at the very end of the episode. Pike says to the bridge crew, "I saw the future. It's whatever kind of adventure we want it to be," which sounds like things are just wide open now. Like, you know, I think the message is for each individual person to don't feel like you're locked into your circumstances. You know, the future can be what you make it. Yes. That's the general message. Yeah. But when it comes out of the mouth of Pike, it and with everything that we saw in that dream sequence, it feels like they're kind of saying that, you know, that ending for Pike that we all know is coming and that he's been struggling with all this time, that's kind of off the table now.
I think you had pinpointed this in another episode we did, but it's like these writers sometimes forget that words have actual meaning. And when you say words, especially in different characters' mouths, it creates an alternate reality, because the words are what are creating the reality on the screen. Mm-hmm. And you can't just say whatever you want to say, the little platitudes that you would hear in a Disney movie, just follow your heart and like not have it have some sort of meaning in this type of environment. When you say that you have put yourselves in a shackle of, you're going to be, you know, beholden to this timeline, but then what you say and what you do don't match that at all. And again, like, I think that's one of the things, right? It doesn't matter what you say. It only matters what you do. Who you are is what you do. We as human beings are that way. And so is what is put on screen in a show. What you've done with Strange New Worlds, I think, in many ways, has made it impossible to adhere to the prime timeline and have the show be in that and make it make sense. Now, if you're okay holding contradictions in your mind, that's fine, you know, and it is fiction. But Star Trek specifically has worked diligently for over the years that it's existed is to not be inconsistent when it doesn't have to be on purpose. There are makeup changes and all, you know, look, we all understand the realities outside of the show, but the show inside has always worked very diligently. And it's one of the reasons why fans then, you know, Voyager, for example, right? As we've been going through Voyager, as you get later into those seasons, there are places where you start to scratch your head because a character does this, but then you kind of remember a few seasons back and you're left with, okay, that's a real inconsistency. And it's not like humans can't be inconsistent, but what I'm trying to get to is that everything that you've said just adds fuel to that fire of being kind of left in the dark as to what they're trying to do with this show. So another example of this, and I think this is a perfect example. The way that we explain the Vesda as being pure evil, but they are apparently evil beyond our conception in the sense that they're the original evil. Like, they're the original sin.
That didn't make any sense to be.
What? And so all of our conceptions of evil come from interactions with them. So are you saying that there's no actual evil in the sense of like any action by somebody can't be either good or evil unless it was influenced by the Vesda? Like, what you're saying actually doesn't make any logical sense. And yet they think it seems cool for the story. But that's, again, this is the big difference between, say, this and Deep Space Nine, where you had the Pa Wraiths and the Prophets, and you had that ambiguity, right? Because there were times in which, with the way the show set up the Prophets, you kind of had these weird motives, which you didn't quite understand. It didn't seem to make sense, which, you know, I mean, if we can understand everything about what we believe to be God, then that can't really be God, right? So, but we put this into just this really strange place where, like, oh, the Vesda are evil incarnate. Like, but before anything else existed, they existed and they were the evil. And it's like, wait, what?
See, that's, yeah, that's the thing that doesn't make sense about them, is that the implication is that they are the oldest anything in the universe, and they're pure evil, which would mean that originally the only thing in the universe was pure evil.
Right.
But if there's nothing else, how do you even define something as evil if there's nothing else?
Exactly. Right. And if they were the first thing to exist, how would you know what evil is? Because you would think that was good. And this is like when you get to like a theology discussion, right? Point. You know, in Christianity, you know, with God being the arbiter of what is good and evil, because he is the yardstick, right? He is the original yardstick for what is good and what is evil. And it's because God is all good, and therefore anything that's against him is evil. But to say then all of a sudden that the Vesda are all evil, and yet somehow good comes out of that, that doesn't make sense. Things can be corrupted, but things can't be made better without something drastic happening, right? You can, it's like the law of thermodynamics, right? Everything winds down into chaos. Things don't generally, scientifically, actually get better. They get worse.
Right.
And so therefore, to say we started off with the worst and somehow it makes no logical sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. This is where, not that this would make it make more sense, but this is at least where them trying to introduce the Q element into the story of the Vesda could at least have been a way for them to have a counterweight of another ancient, super powerful race and tell some story there. Although that doesn't necessarily work either, because they went to the old Q homeworld with the implication that the Q used to be kind of like humans and then evolved, but the Vesda are much older than that. So I don't know. This is the thing where the thing about Star Trek Discovery that it got me before every single season with the teasers is that every season there's some like galactic, you know, life-ending galactic crisis that they must resolve or else the whole universe is going to die. And like season after season, it's like that. And you get to the point where you feel like, you know, we don't have to have galactic stakes in every story to tell a good story. The Vesda here feel like they're created for that type of season where, exactly. I said this earlier, 100%. Right? Where okay, we're going to have this like galactic crisis and the crew has to somehow solve the mystery and then defeat the pure evil, right? But you need a whole season to tell that story, right? Yes, it feels like 100%. It was created for that, or it doesn't. It doesn't feel like it was created for that. It feels like it would have been well suited for that. It feels like it was created just to give some kind of a plot for ultimately for the finale, to be honest, because we only really see them in one episode earlier in the season. And so it feels like early in the season, we're going to set up our finale, but we're not going to actually develop that story at all. And then when we get to the end, it's just going to be there to drive the plot of the final episode. And then we just put the cap on the bottle and we're done with it. So,
I think that's a great way to put it. No, I think you really have kind of pinpointed some of the major issues with this. And the other point about this is, look, We have all experienced really well thought out series, right? You think of reading the Harry Potter series, right? And J.K. Rowling had that planned out from beginning to end. There were minor adjustments of things that changed in the writing of that series, but the end was already known. And so she knew exactly kind of what was going to happen in almost every turn in that. You know, you think of other really well done series where that, you know, you just come out of it thinking, wow, all of that really worked together well. And that's the kind of thing where, as I was just, you know, talking about at the beginning, if you're going to do this kind of season, you really do have to go in and plot every point of the plot through every single episode to make it all connect and make sense so that it works as a whole. Instead of kind of piecemealing it together just as you go, I mean, that's when you end up with the Star Wars sequel trilogy where it's like things just don't connect here. And you know, that's why people were very frustrated, say, with that series, because it just didn't make sense in the end. It didn't really work because it hadn't been well thought out. That's the reason the original six Star Wars films, regardless of what you think of the prequels, George Lucas, you know, when he starts the original Star Wars movie, he had created this massive understanding of his world and kind of how it worked. Are there things that changed? Yes, that's what happens.
Yeah, now he changed things along the way, but he had an idea of where it started and where it ended. Right.
So, and that's just, you know, again, with the Vesda, we kind of end up with this plot that it's almost like, you know how in the United States, there's the bridge to nowhere that, you know, got built, and people were so frustrated with this idea that we wasted all of this money and all this time on this bridge to nowhere. And in a lot of ways, that is kind of where this story is. It's this story to nowhere because it doesn't find a way to do the thing that you need a prequel series to do, which is to create stories that feel like they truly are impacting the characters in ways that are really, really important. And I know people are going to go, but what about what's happening with Spock and what Uhura and Kirk and all that kind of stuff? And it's like, I guess maybe, but in the end too, we know where they end up. We know the end of their stories as well. And so I guess it's kind of fun to have some of these background information, but a lot of this stuff that we're learning seems to like either not feel congruous with their stories in the future anyway. And then we've got all the other characters from Strange New Worlds, which we've continued to talk about, where it's like, I really want to dig into the characters here that I'll never see again in other places. And, you know, and that's the place where, you know, we're not getting kind of the, again, the promise of the show.
Yeah. And I think time is running out on that, right? We're gonna less and less likely to delve into any of these characters.
That's an excellent point. So,
and you know, there was a point during the Nexus dream sequence about the life that Patel and Pike had together, where I said I felt like they were kind of fast forwarding us through Pike's life. And there was a point where I felt like maybe they're clearing the deck for season four and this is going to be it for Pike. And then, you know, Kirk is going to come on in and maybe he's not in the command chair yet somehow. But like it felt like they're like trying to really rush us through this. And, you know, an interesting thing, though, about this story and a possible explanation for why it feels the way it does is that Myers said that they did write this episode so that it could serve as a series finale if it needed to. And it feels a little weird to say that when we're just watching it now and we know they've already shot season four. So you're going pretty far back, but I suppose that at the point, certainly at the point when they were writing this season and writing this story, and maybe when they were producing it, they weren't certain how much time they were going to have left. And if you look at, you know, Discovery was canceled. It was a surprise when it was canceled. And they had to get the studio to let them go back and shoot more to create a proper series ending to the final episode of season 5, whereas it was originally written to transition into season 6. And so I can understand that they don't want to get caught off guard here. And the example I've been giving for years is they certainly don't want to push the studio for renewal and do something like they did with the ending of ALF, where we just got a cliffhanger that never got resolved because ALF got canceled and we don't know what happens when the spaceship comes down. But I think that does explain a lot of why this episode feels the way it does. And it very much explains the very ending of the episode where they're back on the ship and we see different members of the crew together, laughing, talking. Pike comes on the bridge, delivers the line that I said earlier. I saw the future, it's whatever kind of adventure we want it to be. And then there's the discussion about, you know, wow, we've discovered so many planets, so many places for us to go, enough for a 5-year mission. And, you know, if there were never, ever another episode of Strange New Worlds, you could look at this episode and that ending and say, yeah, that's how they wrapped up the series. And going back to the Pike thing, and the reason I felt that way, and I think what we see with Pike and that memory sequence about his possible future, I think it makes sense in the context of this might be the series finale. And the writers are telling us that the future for Pike, where he ends up in the chair, disformed, it might happen, it might not happen. There are many possible paths for him now, but we're never going to be able to show them to you. So it's up to you to imagine what might happen to this character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're right in the sense that this, and obviously that was what they wanted. This felt like a, you know, series finale if they needed it to be. If this had been the series finale, whew, it would have been not the best, but not the worst either. And yeah. I think, it really leaves you in a place where you've got to pray that they get their act together for the next 2 seasons, knowing that that's all they have. And think mm-hmm. long and hard about, and you know, they've already finished season 4 and they're on to season 5 now in filming. So I'm guessing we're not going to get those seasons too far apart from one another, hopefully. You know, we're not waiting forever. And I think one of the things that made this feel also just so, I don't know what the correct term is, because I don't want to use the term that gets thrown around because this is a little off color, but it is like some of the worst type of fan fiction, this whole thing we have going with Spock and Kirk, you know, it just doesn't work as a storyline. And honestly, it has not been set up well enough that Spock would say, well, you seem like a guy who does the unnormal and the unexpected, so you're the person I'm going to choose for this.
No, but Matthew, remember, Spock, he's been looking back in the media library in the Enterprise computer, and he watched all the J.J. Abrams movies.
Okay, that makes... So, see, the Kelvin timeline makes so much more sense. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's a place where... You know, that's kind of the B story for this in a lot of ways. And
at best, and I think it's more like a Z story.
And
it's
just
such a tiny,
it just really feels so forced. It feels so silly and goofy. And it's just like one of those things where, I'm sorry, but starships, if they have prefix codes, then you should be able to give the computer of each starship the prefix code for the other, and then mirror the action between the computers to make this possible. There's so many other ways to make this happen, right? Than to do this thing where we're going to force Jim and Spock together in a way that feels so artificial and way too fast. Like,
Jim and
Spock were not this close, this fast by the time they were serving on the same ship. It doesn't feel real. It just feels like, oh, well, we want these characters to be together. And so plot reason to smash them together in a way where now they can read each other's minds. Because, you know, Spock knows about what happened on Orion.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought the whole sequence was really quite silly. And also, it didn't make any sense for the plot why they would even need to do this at all. I did feel a little echo of All Good Things when they're sitting at the table and Kirk says, two ships firing energy at the same time, at the same target, right? So I think it was a little bit of an homage to All Good Things in a sense there.
And the problem becomes, and we've talked extensively about this in this episode, when you begin to make somebody think about better done episodes, it shines a light on the deficiency of the writing of this episode. And I think that that's one of the places that as this season ends, and in all honesty, I've looked at other major publications. IO9, which is a major you know, geek website, called this an incredibly uneven season. I'm not one who thinks this. You're not the only one who thinks this. There are many, even in fandom, who also think the same thing as well. This season, a lot of people. Yeah, feels very disjointed. And so,
in fact, that's the most common reaction to the season as a whole that I have seen, is that even if people are overall more positive about every episode than we sometimes have been, still people feel like the season has been uneven. And then there have been some explanations for that. But let's come back to that in a moment, though, because I just want to say one more thing about this whole two starships need to fire their weapons at this portal so that Pike and Batale can get through.
Two starships, two weapons, two characters, one target.
Just see the poster now.
It basically looks like the Generations poster, and that's the tagline.
That's the tagline, yeah. I need to create that.
It'd be amazing.
Just from a story point of view, though, it really didn't make any sense because so Zaperez / Gamble and Mbenga, they need to be together and then they can go through the portal. Now, Batel and Pike, if Batel is the Beholder statue itself.
I know.
And then Pike is integral to her love that enables her to become the Beholder statue in the first place and defeat the Vesda.
Preach.
How is she not admitted through the portal? It doesn't make any sense at all.
But you know what, Chris? A magic portal can be forced open by the power of almost the sun.
Almost the sun. Almost. And it doesn't harm anyone standing near the portal. It simply opens the portal so two people can walk through it.
I don't understand how you don't understand this. Like, what do you not understand? Do I need to say it slower or...
Please, Matthew, more slowly.
You're just going too fast, you need to man. Say it.
You need to say it in many, 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 many languages. So this is the other thing, though, that I was really disappointed that there was no explanation ever given. So if you go back to the Indiana Jones episode, La'an is looking around the statue and there's text there in Chinese, which she can read, which I thought, what are you doing here? Are you doing this because La'an as a character can read Chinese, or are you doing it because of Christina Chong's ancestry? Like, it didn't make any sense, right? Why that's there. It also didn't make any sense of why this Chinese would be here on this planet being an Earth language, other than later it's sort of implied that the Vesda being this ancient evil have been all over the universe. And so like every planet they've encountered. Okay, that's fine. You get here and then you've got Swahili so that both Uhura and Mbenga can read it. And then Mbinga realizes that the message is about him. Okay, well, that opens all kinds of questions about how these inscriptions come to be on the portal, around the statue, wherever they are, and what they mean and how they connect to individual people. And none of this is ever, other than the fact that this message in Swahili is about Mbinga himself, there's no explanation ever given as to how these languages play into the Vesda. And I understand they didn't have time to go into that, but they could have put some kind of little mention in. It's very disappointing and unsatisfying as a viewer. An element like that, that's so mysterious and is just screaming for some kind of explanation, is only used in this one moment to allow Mbinga to realize he needs to go through the portal, and there's nothing else to it.
Chris, let me introduce you to my friend.
Say hello to my little friend.
Plot magic. We need a thing to happen. Plot magic. There's this language here that shouldn't really be here. Plot magic. Plot magic. Can't figure it out. Just use plot magic. It's like the easy button for Staples. But easier, because it's, you just sprinkle a little bit of plot magic on there and your problems are fixed.
I see. Yeah. So you can buy it at like Office Depot or Office
Exactly.
Max.
Yeah. I think it's at Writer's Depot, because like, I mean, how many people Writer's need Depot. Plot magic if you're not like a writer? So, you know,
I was picturing like an issue of Writer's Digest magazine. You've got like a full page ad for plot magic.
Yeah. And if you're lucky, your plot magic comes with a plot fairy. And then you just sprinkle on like pixie dust, but it's plot magic dust. And that's when it's really potent, and that's when it actually works really well.
I thought you used the dust on the viewers themselves. You sprinkle it on the viewers, and then they just accept whatever it is that you've presented.
That's where you need like a plot elephant, because you know you can't sprinkle that amount of dust on at people with just a fairy that's so small. So there's no way, Chris, that doesn't make any sense. What are you talking about, Chris? That's ridiculous. I think the state of, you know, a quick discussion we should have, and then we should let everybody go, but like a quick discussion of the state of Strange New Worlds, because, you know, on a whole, the first two seasons I thought were very enjoyable. The second season, not as much as the first season, which felt really focused. And this show just seems to have lost its focus. And the big loss of focus really has been the characters and the characters being the ones driving the stories. And I think we can see this most readily in the character of Patel, who is not well served by this show really at all. There's nothing about her character that is all that interesting other than to be a plot device for Pike and then a plot device for the series as a whole. And we don't really get to know her as a character or her really matter as a character, because really all she is is a plot device. And this is the problem when we are telling stories that are not driven by what the characters are making us do as writers. Part of that, I think, comes from, obviously, there is a place here where we have to acknowledge there was a strike and all that stuff, and then you're rushing to try and get things done. But even if you're a writer on strike, I can't imagine that you don't have thought processes about where these characters are going to go, so that when you come back to work, you're ready to put those to work for the characters. And so I hope and I pray, I know, and this worries me greatly, but they talked about this in an interview that, hey, we took wild swings in season three, and you know what? We're going to double down. And that really worries me for the character stories, because it feels like they care more about their wild swings than they actually do care about telling great stories for the characters to which they've created, and they're supposed to be servicing these legacy characters. Mm-hmm. And that is a little bit frustrating to me as a viewer and somebody who, I want to reiterate this, I've continued to watch this show not just because we do Saddle Up. I like these actors. And those first two seasons, and especially that first season, it pulled me in. It made me a believer, and it made me want to see more of these characters. It made me want to see more of these actors. In some places, I feel like they've done an excellent job with that. Like, I think, if I'm to praise anything, the way in which we've dealt with the character of La'an is maybe the best example of this, where we've made her a fully fledged, full-rounded character who is much more deep and interesting than she was when we started.
Yeah.
A character, you know, that it's a, I would say maybe a not so great example of this is actually the character of Number One, where we've had one important episode for her and everything else has been kind of blah or just incredibly silly. And we've never really...
But that's not to say that Rebecca Romijn hasn't done an excellent job with the character.
And
it's just
not,
that the writers haven't given us enough.
This has nothing to do with the actors.
Her. Right.
This has to do with the writing and what they're being given. I love these actors. I think they're great in their roles. And so what I'm asking for and what I'm kind of begging for is they deserve good writing. This show deserves good writing. And season one showed us that they could do it. Well, I will see where we go, I guess, with season 4 and 5.
Yeah. So you mentioned La'an. La'an, is a very interesting situation because when they first announced the name of the character, it sounded like a gimmick.
I mean, Spacey is going to be so much more interesting.
We're going to have Noonien Singh on the new show. Isn't that going to be cute, right? But yeah, she's turned into a very interesting character and a pretty well-rounded character. And you mentioned the strike. So this is an interesting thing because I do think that there is something to that. But the explanation that I've seen is that Myers and Goldsman have talked about the strike. And the explanation that I've heard is that, yes, they were impacted by the strike in some sense, that they were writing before the strike and then the strike happened, and as we all know, that was quite a prolonged strike. But then when they came back, they didn't have time for rewrites. So the suggestion, and I don't know if it's true, I don't know if it's an excuse, I would think that you would find the time. Like if you feel like something really needs to be fixed, something needs to be adjusted, you'd find a way to do it. Even if it's on the set, rewriting a line in the moment, like you'd find a way to make an adjustment if you need to, but you can feel it when you watch the show. And I think that's one reason why plot lines, character behaviors and things don't mesh through the season is that they started down one path and then maybe as they got to the later stuff, they realized something wasn't fitting together, wasn't working, but then they couldn't fix it. And so they just end up going with what they had.
Well, and that's the thing. Look, I'm sorry, but to say we don't have time to fix it, that's not true. You chose not to fix it. You could have taken the time to fix this. You could have said to the studio, hey, look, we started these episodes, but unless you want a half-assed season, then, I mean, you want to give us an extra like 4 months and we can really make this thing great. And so I look, that's a choice that you made, but I mean, you know, you all made the choice to also strike. And so that, look, we've got to take responsibility for all the actions that were taken here. And so, hey, if you felt like you needed a strike and you did, okay, more power to you, but don't blame that on the quality of the work, because you're the ones who chose to strike. And so you I don't think you can really necessarily blame that.
Yeah, I agree. It shouldn't be something that you're blaming for why something turned out the way that it did. whether they could get more time from the studio, I don't know. You would think that they would be able to. I mean, we had to wait so long to get the season in the first place. What does it matter?
Well, right? I mean, exactly. What is maybe 1 month of rewrites for the scripts going to matter?
Mm-hmm. Right. Except in today's environment, the studio might be saying, well, you know, we don't have any more money, so we can't pay more for you to go in and rewrite stuff. In which case, I would think as a creative who really cares about the work that I'm doing, I've already been paid for what I've written. I would spend a little time and go in and fix something, even if it's right on my own time,
yeah,
if they would let me do it. And I say that as a creative professional,
absolutely,
as a writer myself, yep, as an editor, I would do that. I'm not just saying that as a random fan, like, hey, why don't you donate your time? You know, it's what I would do personally.
I mean, you write as a living. You publish written material in magazines. That's what you do.
Right, right, right. And I care about the final product that I put out because that's going to be there forever, right? So, but, you know, they say that, yeah, season four is going to be better. They're going to
Well, we're getting
stabilize
puppets,
things,
you know,
and,
so and there's yeah, real hope, Chris.
The puppet doesn't give me a lot of hope, but, you know, it's interesting, though. I've been going back and my wife and I have been rewatching from the start of season one, and I've been watching the extras on the season one Blu-rays over the past week. And it's interesting to hear Akiva Goldsman talk about the show in those extras, because the things that he says about the show make a whole lot more sense in season one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can tell that,
yeah,
when this show spun off from Discovery, they had a very clear idea of what this show was and the story that they were going to tell,
right,
with Pike. And I think when you watch that first season, you feel like it's a very solid season. And then you go into season two, and for the most part, especially the first half, I think is still quite good. And they start to get a little bit silly along the way. But even when they do that, like Subspace Rhapsody, it works. Like, it's a good episode. We thought, well, what's going to happen with this? But we came away from it like, wow, that was actually really good. You know, and I have the vinyl of the soundtrack now. You know, I like that episode. But then this season just felt like something was going on. So, you know, overall, most episodes I've enjoyed as a Star Trek fan, even though I do have issues with a lot of the things that happen in the episodes from a creative standpoint, from a writing standpoint. But like you said, the actors are phenomenal. And I think that's something that there's this tendency in social media, especially these days, where you can't say anything critical about anything. When you watch a TV show, if you have any kind of constructive criticism, you're a hater, right? But it's not that. I think we've said it here on Saddle Up before, that if we didn't love Star Trek, if we didn't care about the show,
right,
we wouldn't even bother doing a podcast. We wouldn't bother thinking about it or considering other
with the way the numbers have gone down in listenership, Chris, because people only want to listen to famous people on podcasts. Yeah, we wouldn't spend the time to do this if we didn't love it.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, one episode of Saddle Up takes you and me combined at least 10 hours to do an episode, right? You know, it takes me, I know I spend at least 5-6 hours preparing, editing, publishing the episode. So it's a real time commitment, right? So obviously we care about the show, and that's the reason that we have constructive criticism about it. But to be very clear, right, the actors on the show are fantastic. And
agreed.
You know, they're not being given the best material much of the time, but they absolutely make the most of it. And even this episode we're talking about today, the ending in particular, as unsatisfying as that ending was for what happened to Batel and the Vesta and all, Anson Mount sells it at the end. He gives the emotional weight, at least to how it impacted him as a character in Pike. And, you know, I can't say enough about the actors. I can't say enough about the creators behind the scenes working on the visuals and the set design and the costume design, the editors doing the color grading and all the stuff that goes into this stuff. Everyone, it's phenomenal. Really, I mean, it's an amazing looking show. And I just wish that the pieces of the plots and the stories and all were thought out better. You mentioned earlier, like Harry Potter with J.K. Rowling. You mentioned Star Wars with George Lucas. And a key to making all that work, and we talk about Deep Space Nine a lot as well, a key to making all that work, though, is that you need to have some guiding hand creatively. In the cases of something like Star Wars or Harry Potter, you've got one individual who created it, and it's their vision. And other people work with them on it and help create the final product, but you have this guiding vision to it. And I think that what I feel here is that I don't see that there is a strong guiding vision for where the story should go. And so when you have individual writers teaming up and putting together these episodes, if you don't have someone who's truly like really guiding what's going on, you're going to end up with kind of a mishmash of stories that and threads that don't actually come together. And when you do pull them together, it feels hollow.
Or and you might
anyway.
End
that's
up-
ultimately how I feel about this season. Even though I do like individual episodes, but just if I give my honest assessment of the season as a whole, uneven is definitely the word for it.
The other thing, Chris, you might end up with a season where the finale ends like you're watching a CW teen drama with a wonderful pop song. Maybe they actually play in the
in the mess hall?
The mess hall, in the relaxation lounge, whatever that bar is that they go to all the time.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, come on. I think, to me, that's the true moment, honestly, that this show jumped the shark, is when they decided that the way to end the season is by ending it the way that every CW show ended every season of its show, where you had a voiceover and you had a pop song. And it's like, that's not what Star Trek is. Star Trek is Shakespearean. It is theatrical. It is not what we just see in every other TV show. And I think you rightly pinpointed, that's what's missing, is that the people in charge don't actually seem to understand the core of what Star Trek is. They think it's just another TV show, but Star Trek has its own language, its own understanding of how it's made and the things that happen and the things that don't happen. It doesn't just work like every other single show. It's existed for so long because it has adhered to this idea of what Star Trek actually is. And when, you know, Roddenberry helped create The Next Generation, he continued that. He really set that template, and then Berman carried that on into his era. And whether you liked it or not, that was one of the beauties of Rick Berman. He was so protective of what Star Trek was, of the thing that had been handed to him.
Yeah, 100%.
And he truly understood it in a way that I think is kind of beautiful, because he didn't treat it as if it was his own thing to do whatever he wanted with. No,
right.
Berman knew this was Roddenberry's thing, and I am here to guard his vision. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think...
And you can evolve it.
Right.
But
exactly,
you have to evolve it within the framework.
And this is what happened with Star Trek. It's also what happened with the things that have not worked in the Star Wars world, where somebody has come in and not wanted to adhere to what Star Wars is by understanding what the rules of that universe are, so that you could also know then, okay, how do I bend these? Because one of the things that I've learned from a good friend of mine that I won't name, but works in the biz, has said, and he learned this from the incredible people that he worked with, you have to understand the rules before you can figure out if they are bendable and or if there's a way to break them.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we are, I think, with this Paramount Plus version of Star Trek. We don't know necessarily what the I Ching of Star Trek is. We don't necessarily want to adhere to what the rules of Star Trek are. We don't understand them enough to know how to bend them, and we definitely don't understand them enough on how to break them. And mm-hmm. that is where you run into these issues. And it is frustrating because, again, let me reiterate, if you're still listening, I love Star Trek, and I love these characters, and I actually love these actors. And the reason I say all these things is not because I'm some sort of hater, and I just like to complain. I'm saying these things because I want these actors to have the best show possible because I think they deserve it. Because yeah. I think they're good enough to deserve it. And let's hope that, you know, season 4 and 5 maybe give us more of that. But Chris, I think mm-hmm. we've talked probably enough about this episode, and maybe we should just go ahead with giving our ratings.
All right. So what's your rating for this one?
I think I'm going to have to go, I'm going to be generous, honestly, and I'm going to go straight down the middle. I'm going to give this a 5 out of 10 Vezdas.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's kind of like half a good idea here. I think there's kind of half a good episode. But what makes an episode go beyond half good is where the execution really lies. And that becomes, I think, the issue with this episode, is that the execution of it just fails on so many levels that it can't mm-hmm. actually do something with the ideas that it has. Because it just all mm-hmm. feels, and I hate to say this, it just feels half-baked.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like we got to wrap up the season, and we might have to wrap up the series as well. So this is it. Let's just put it all up there.
Closing time.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I feel pretty much the same way. There are a lot of good ideas in this episode, and I'm really looking forward to the novels that come out that explore the Vezda in more depth, because I think there's a lot of fascinating stuff that you could do with that idea in the hands of a good writer and a novel where you actually have time to dig in to the ideas that you have for them and explore that. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, I mean, it's an okay episode. It's not a terrible episode. It's just that it doesn't satisfyingly wrap up all the stories that we saw through the season or Batel's character, who we've seen since the very beginning of the series. But nevertheless, I'm going to give it 6 Scotty dress uniforms.
Ah, great dress uniform.
Which, by the way, I did like that little moment of playing the joke on Scotty and mm-hmm. tying it back into
yes.
Uhura.
Yes, that was great.
Showing up in her dress uniform. And it was done in a very subtle way, like not the same dialogue or anything, just the situation carried it. So I thought that was, and again, Anson Mount's laugh when he saw it. Perfect. Yeah, I did like that. All right, everyone. Well, that is the conclusion of season 3. So of course we will be back in the saddle when season 4 kicks off, if not before then, if something else comes up. But we would love to hear your thoughts on New Life and New Civilizations, a title that I'm not sure sums up the episode very well, but
it does not.
Anyway, we'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And there are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll see a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose Saddle Up, and that will come to us by email. And you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not mind-melding with James T. Kirk, where can people find you?
Whew, man, it is filthy in there. You could find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, you'll find me outside all this great Star Trek talk with Chris over on the 602 Club, talking about all the other franchises that we love. You can also find me on the Nerd Party Network doing a couple of shows. One is completed, called Owl Post, about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and then over on Aggressive Negotiations, talking about Star Wars with the great John Mills. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out just exactly how in the world Battelle got turned into this protector person with all of those. Anyway, where can people find you?
Yeah, it's going to take me a long time. So just going to grab a bottle of wine, go sit under a tree somewhere, maybe figure that out. But
that sounds like a great doing day.
Or maybe while I'm doing that, you can find me everywhere in social media. My username is C Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active, but you can find me everywhere. So I'd love to hear from you. And of course, in the back catalog, you can find me in many episodes and many shows. And Matthew, as you mentioned, we do those other shows together. And now the Saddle Up is wrapped for season 3. Of course, we're going to be jumping back into our rewatches of Voyager and Deep Space Nine and Enterprise. So hope you'll join us over there. And yeah, so that's it. So thank you everyone for listening to Saddle Up for season 3. And Matthew, I think there's enough stuff out there for us to set out on a new 5-year mission.
Well, Chris, as Ortegas would say, let's light this candle.